So it's the Osceola turkey that's only located in Florida. And then we hunted the Eastern here in Alabama. And then we went to Kansas for the Rio. And then we flew from Kansas to South Dakota for the Marions. We went by the National Wild Turkey Federation map. We didn't want there to be any hybridization. Like, kind of when you get close to blended in those lines, you tend to get hybrid. So we went straight off their map is the reason why we picked the areas that we did. I'm Graham Talo, and this is the Tom Rowland Podcast.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the podcast today. We have one of my favorite podcast guests of all times. In fact, it's one of my favorite people to go hunting or fishing with, Graham Talo. He's my good buddy. He's the best turkey hunter that I've ever been around. And he's going to come on the podcast and tell us a story about setting the National Wild Turkey Federation record for the Grand Slam. All four turkeys in a certain time period. They just accomplished it. And it's a really awesome story. And Graham also tells lots of other stories, including this albino turkey that he found and has now killed. And also, while we're talking about those things, he gives a lot of really, really, really good advice for turkey hunters. So if you're a turkey hunter and you're interested in turkeys, this is a particular good one. Graham is an excellent woodsman, and you can learn something from a guy like this. So here we go with Graham Talo. Graham, what's up? You're surrounded by huge animals.
This is my little fly tie room.
Is it?
Uh-huh.
Right on, man. You got some big deer behind you. So what have you been up to? I know we got to catch up on a couple of things. I know what you've been doing, but what does a spring hold for you other than turkey hunting?
Managing habitat, doing a lot of trapping, selling land, not fishing. I've been doing a lot of work here lately, so hadn't been able to do much of that. But we have done a lot. We have done a lot of fun things in the turkey woods this year.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
Well, I know we're going to get to that, but what I mean, that's what you're doing when you say you're managing habitat and you're selling land. We've known each other for a long time, and it took me a while to figure out what it was that you did for a living, because it just seems like you go hunting and fishing all the time. But tell me what would you say if somebody asked you that didn't know you what you did for a living? What would you say?
I sell land for a living, and I help people find farms that are that have really good habitat that they can buy and keep for their family for a long time. And I also enhance those farms for habitat and wildlife, and just a lot of times aesthetics, make bass lakes, things of that nature.
Yeah.
But I primarily sell land, and I work for on the land side, on the habitat stuff. I work for one family farm now. This in Childersburg, Alabama. So I'm having a lot of fun with that, kind of babying that property and bringing it up and making it really neat for wildlife. But I do branch out to people who buy land from me, and I help them on the farm. And I stay involved after they buy the farm. So,
right.
So kind of constantly moving around Alabama.
Did you study anything like that in college, or is this all kind of a lifetime of being in the outdoors that helps you to know all this?
Well, when I went to school, I was this family friend of mine, Kenny Freeman, got me a job with Westervelt Wildlife Services, and I started guiding turkey hunts there. And so it was really there that I guess I got bit by the whole bug of the managing habitat and turkeys. And I saw people turkey hunting in a different way. And it was neat to see their success. And it kind of drove me to want to learn more.
What do you mean in a different way?
I just always came back to them.
You mean like they were successful? And maybe you weren't always at that point.
I mean, with the most novice of clients, they were still able to be successful. And I just found that really interesting. You know, a lot of people can go into the woods and kill a turkey on their own, but when you go and take somebody else that it's not used to that. It's a whole nother element when you bring somebody to the woods that isn't used to it. And so there's another challenge. And it was fun to see those guys overcome those challenges when I was young, you know, 18 years old, and watching them come back. Man, he's got another one. And then the next day, they got another one. So it just kind of showed me that there was a way.
So you're watching these guys go out and get big turkeys or any turkeys with novices. A lot is the same. There's a lot that's similar to that. Like when I first started guiding in the Keys, man, I would see people go out with anglers that were literally terrible, and they would come back with permit or tarpon. And I just thought, man, that's amazing. I mean, guiding will certainly make you a better angler, because of that, because you're having to, overcome so many things, like whether a person can't cast very far or very accurately, or maybe in turkey hunting, I'm sure that it's that they can't sit still long enough. And you know, that has to be
me.
Yeah, you think that's you? No way, man. Yeah. You know when to sit still. You may not be able to sit still very long because you can't pay attention that long, but you know when to sit still. And when it's time, you don't move. You're like moss starts growing on you. I've been with you. But what do you think it was with those guys in turkey hunting that made the difference that you learned, you know, as a young guy watching?
And there's this one guy in particular, his name is George Mayfield. And I just would see this twinkle in his eye, like when he would walk into the woods. It was just hard to describe. It was just like this, I don't know. He was not arrogant. He was just a sense of confidence when he walked in the woods, a sense of peace. And he was a minimalist, which I've become, you know, in the turkey woods. But he was just such a woodsman and knew where to be. And it was just the next level of, it was just like, it's just the next level. It was just a level that I never thought was achievable. And I see this guy doing it. And, you know, it was there that honestly, that's what really spawned me, is watching him. And
you stay in touch with him?
Yep.
Yep. Does he still teach you a lesson or two every now and then?
Well, my buddy Max Adams was along at that time. And me and Max, we stay in contact a lot as well. And Max is like an Indian. Max is more the woodsman. Mm. And he would walk through the woods and not really call much at all, and put himself in the right spot. And so it was neat to be around all these people. And then I got to be around the guides. I got to be around people like Tom Kelly, you know, the famous turkey writer that a lot of people have read a lot of their stuff. I used to sit on the porch with him at Westerville. I didn't even know who I was talking to at the time. And now it's Tom Kelly. But there's a lot of people that influenced me. And maybe I was a little naive, but a lot of the things that they told me, I'll never forget. Mm. And most all.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, that's a great opportunity to be around, you know, people that have more experience than you that are willing to share it. Do you think that, like with Tom Kelly, do you think that there was a time when you're kind of talking to him, or that you kind of have this like an epiphany of things that you're not currently doing, or was it just over time that you just started picking up little things here and there?
Well, I had to slow down. I was a little bit running too fast back then when I was talking to Tom Kelly and things like that. So, I wasn't as absorbent as I should be, you know. Looking back on it now, I'm like, God, what I would give to be sitting on that porch again with him.
Yeah.
But I'll never, you know, I probably won't get that chance again. But now I'm a little bit more absorbent of things, a little bit slower about the way that I walk about the woods instead of trying to force things.
Yeah.
Used to try to force things all the time. Like, and you can't really force things, seems to be in nature. You just kind of got to let it flow. So,
well, I've had the opportunity to go turkey hunting with you. You're definitely the best turkey hunter that I've ever been able to hunt with. And, it's pretty cool because we went even to my land and we're hunting, you know, in a place that I know. And then you just do it. It's just like going with a really good fishing guide. You know, you go to the same spot, but you do things just a little bit different, and that little bit different makes all the difference in the world. And whether that's hunting or fishing or really whatever, the guys that really know what's happening, they only do it slightly different, but those little nuances are what make all the difference, in my opinion. That's what I see, you know, when I'm watching people, like, man, that's, I was close, but I wasn't there. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that sounds like my tarpon fishing career.
Yeah. Well, you'll learn the same with the tarpon fishing, and that you're really close, but just a couple little changes will make all the difference in the world. Now, one of the things that, like, you sent me two things recently. One is the world record, and you tell us about this whole, I mean, this record that you're trying to get is pretty incredible, honestly. And so it's the National Wild Turkey Federation has a record for the Grand Slam, and it's gotten down to numbers of hours rather than numbers of days or weeks or months that it would take to kill all four turkeys. And that's the record that you just went after, right?
Yeah, well, my buddy John Casmus was the one that was pursuing the goal. He's been a friend of mine, I guess, since I was 10 years old. Mm-hmm. You know, he was actually my football coach when I was younger. And he called me a pro day of him and Slade Johnson. It's pretty neat. Concept they had was to try to beat that world record. And
what was it before? It was
46 hours and some change.
46 hours. So for people that don't know much about turkey, where are these four turkeys located in the country?
So it's the Osceola turkey that's only located in Florida. And then we hunted the Eastern here in Alabama. And then we went to Kansas for the Rio. And then we flew from Kansas to South Dakota for the Marions. Mm-hmm. We went by the National Wild Turkey Federation map. We didn't want there to be any hybridization, like, kind of when you get close to blended in those lines, you tend to get hybrid. So we went straight off their map is the reason why we picked the areas that we did.
Okay. And so you, in order to do this in what was the previous record? 46 hours?
46 hours.
So yeah. In order to even to go from Florida to Alabama to Kansas to South Dakota, right? Those are the places that you went. I mean, that's a lot of traveling. So you've got to do this in 46 hours. I mean, do you start with where do you even start with this? Do you start with the logistics and then obviously, you know, different places? Who knows all the information? I mean, just how does it even start? I don't even know. That's such a huge area and such a huge accomplishment that I wouldn't even know where to start. How did you guys do it?
So Slade Johnson has a company called Trips for Trade, where like if I was going to take somebody striper fishing, I could trade somebody a striper trip for a hunt in Kansas, vice versa. So he's real, really well connected with people all around the state. I mean, all around the United States with these neat places. So Slade was heading up where we went. Okay. And he was behind the logistics. And, we were the first part about logistics. We knew we wanted to finish in Kansas and South Dakota, but we didn't know whether we wanted to start on the Osceola or the Eastern first. And we figured we should try to get the hardest turkey that we know first, which was the Alabama Eastern. So we started with the Eastern and, you know, we're trying to kill them. This is one thing that in the end, it kind of comes back to doubt. But we're trying to kill them as fast as possible. So right off the limb, we move into a roost site and the turkeys are behind us. They fly down. You know how it goes with the cameras. They can't get on them. So we had let them walk off and that's the way that went. And we ended up calling that group back up. Long story short, we ended up killing one at like 9:30 for the Eastern in Alabama. And we went straight from there to Florida. When we got to Ocala, Florida, Paul was our host there. He was a great guy. And he had been seeing this turkey in front of his house, kind of in front of his pasture. So we went and set up on him. You know, Osceolas are slick. A lot of times they'll come out and just back up, like get the heebie-jeebies and just back up. I mean, they're bad about coming inside and walking off quick. And so that's exactly what happened to us right off the bat. And we were sitting there thinking that we were going to have to go back to Alabama and start over again. This was going through our mind, like we're going to have to go tomorrow back to Alabama, kill a turkey and start over. About that time, two turkeys come out of the palmettos directly to the north of us. And they were going to roost, you know, just right over here. But we tried to yelp at them, and they were kind of non-responsive. They were following one hen. And there was a little dip in the terrain and a big block of palmettos, and John ran over there and got kind of in the way. And when they came out behind the palmettos, he got them that way. And so that was 20 minutes left to spare in Florida, or else we were going to have to go back to Alabama and start over.
So you guys had it down to a timeline to where you thought, okay, we're going to start here, and we need to get the second one by this amount of time so that we have enough time to get the rest of them done. And you had it down to 20 minutes to spare that you could be in Florida.
Well, we were down to 20 minutes of legal shooting light. We were about to run out of shooting light. You know, it was in the afternoon, and you know, we didn't want to do anything. He couldn't, I mean, we're filming the whole thing, and not the, you know, we had 20 minutes left of legal shooting light. And, that just happened the way it worked. They worked, they came out. And, you know, right there about 10 minutes before, and it worked out great. And so off to Kansas we went, and we met.
So how do you get to Kansas?
John is the pilot. The guy that was John Casmus, who was doing the shooting, was the pilot of the plane. And so we flew to the plane, got in the air, flying, and we landed in Kansas about 2:30 in the morning. And slept in an interesting place for about an hour or so. And our guide Casey there had been on these turkeys, and he had roosted them the evening before. So we wanted to get under them early because it was opening day of Kansas season. So I think we were an hour and a half before daylight under the turkey, sitting where we needed to be. And sure enough, at daylight, they were in the corner of the field. And that hunt was just textbook. They flew down, worked right in. It was like a 15-minute hunt. And it was just a beautiful thing out there. And so we jumped in the plane, sprinted to South Dakota, and we went to an Indian reservation in South Dakota for the Marions. And Sean, the guy who has a homestead in the middle of the Indian reservation, met us at the airport and drove us straight to the turkeys. We got there about 11 in South Dakota. And so here we are, we're sitting on about 24 hours. In 21 hours, we had killed the three species. Wow. And we're about to get the Merriam's. As soon as we get out of the car, we saw them. And, but you know how things go in turkey, honey, it never goes as planned.
Right.
So we got in there to hunt the Merriam. We yelped one up right off the bat. And he was just over rise, and they couldn't really get him on camera. And that turkey walked off. And so we hunted for like the dark that day. Had a couple opportunities, but not really good. And so we're going into the last night. That afternoon we got back, we were just bummed. We thought we were done. And the guy there, Sean, had done the math. And he's like, hey, because y'all killed the turkey in Alabama at 9:30, you have 23 minutes of shooting light in the morning to be 46 hours. And we're like dragging back to the truck thinking it's over. And he says that, we're like, okay. Huh. But so the next morning it was 21 degrees and my clothes were soaking wet from the sweat from the day before. So I let Sean and John and Slade, who's a really great caller as well, they went down to the roost and killed the turkey in like 10 minutes. And it was just an amazing hunt. And it, you know, it ended in 45 hours. So 45 hours, 52 minutes is what it was.
Wow.
And so it was all to benefit the NWTF. I think we got like 237 National Wild Turkey Federation memberships during the process.
Nice.
And raised over $23,000 for the National Wild Turkey Federation, which is an awesome, you know.
So how did you raise that money? What are people, they giving you money per turkey or what?
No, here's where John and Slade come in again. They had this where you could pick, it was called under36.com, and you could pick the time you thought it would take us to get to accomplish it. So everybody's picking, and there are raffles all throughout the thing. They're raffling stuff off. I don't know if you saw the sponsor list, but there were lots of sponsors that got behind this. And, a lot of competing brands, everybody was just involved in it because it was for the National Wild Turkey Federation for turkeys. And so we were just raffling stuff off constantly. And every time you would make a guess, you would give it, it would be a donation to the NWTF. So we raised $23,000 for the NWTF.
Wow.
During the process. So it was just a really neat thing to be a part of.
Wow.
But I'm not sure if I'd want to do it again.
Yeah. that sounds like there wasn't a lot of sleep.
Like 5 hours and 48.
5 hours of sleep. So, but to beat it, you would have to, I guess it's entirely possible that you could, you were there at 21 hours or something. It could have happened. And that would have probably
Could have been done in 26 hours if we had just gone over the hill. And you know what I call it, Tom, when you rise up on top of the hill and you can get them. But I'm not going to say it on the podcast, but that could have happened.
Yeah.
He was up there for a minute.
Yeah. Well, but, you left a little room for somebody else to come and try it again.
Hey, and that's the whole thing with the under36.com is they're there to promote anybody who wants to try to do it again and facilitate that and help them, give them any advice. So that's a pretty neat thing.
Wow.
Because we know there's a lot of great turkey hunters in the world and they're coming to do.
Yeah.
So.
Well, they got to have some other things too, like a plane. You think you could do that in a truck? You couldn't do it in a truck.
No. And the amount of mistakes you can make are so minimal. You put yourself into a mindset of hunting where you're like, I've never been in many fishing tournaments, but I felt like I was almost forcing things in a way where I should have been just letting it, like if I was just hunting with my friends, I would have just been letting it go and it probably happened a lot quicker. But since so much was on the line, I maybe hunted a little bit different than I would have normally.
Yeah. But you can't argue with success. I mean, that's success. Four turkeys, four states in a short amount of time. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, we had a crew of people most of the time. So I don't know if you got a chance to see the video, but they did a really neat job on it.
That's awesome. So in your opinion, which was the most difficult?
Yeah. Well, the Alabama turkey and the Osceola was the most difficult for sure.
Yeah.
But, the South Dakota turkeys were driver error. We put ourselves in some situations and terrain that maybe looking back on it, probably could have done differently. But I don't know. They all had their flair. We had a guy with a flashlight in Kansas come underneath the roosted turkey off a neighboring property. So that was... that was hard to watch, but it ended up making the turkey fly down early. So, but, there were pink elephants, as I call them, and then in all the hunts. For sure.
Really? Like something that was going wrong on every one of them, every single one of these turkeys.
100%. Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah.
That's funny. But that's what's incredible about it is that you made it happen, even with all the different people, all the different, you know, timelines, everything else, you guys made it happen. So Had you ever, you had hunted all four of these species, right? Before?
Yeah, several times. Yeah. I have.
So is there a difference from one to the other, in your opinion?
You know, the Eastern is big cat and mouse. But you know, it doesn't like to be called to a lot. Doesn't like to be power called to. You got to do a lot more waiting after you call. The Osceola is straight up like a slick Eastern. I think that in certain terrains that they're even wilier because they live in tighter terrain with that palmetto and stuff like that. And the Osceola is just, from the most times I've hunted them, you just got to be very, you can't be messing around. You got to be looking all the time because they're going to sneak in there and try to get a look and try to see the hen. And if you're not looking, I mean, just a little bit, he may back out. Mm. And so then you go to the Rios. They're very, the Rios gobble a lot, so you can roost them in the evenings.
Yeah.
And that really helps with your position the next morning. The Merriams, they gobble a ton. They gobble all day. They're very nomadic. So they may go like a mile one day where you think they're just in this area, but really they're 1,000 acres away. And so they all have their thing. And in the open country, like the Merriams and the Rios, you really want to use like a friction call, like a box call or a slate call, something that'll penetrate the wind. Whereas when you're hunting Easterns and Osceolas, you really want to be quiet, you know, a lot more quiet with your calling, a lot more natural. But the more volume you can get on the Rios and the Merriams, the better. Hmm. Just because that's dense air, the country's real open, and the sound just doesn't carry.
Right.
Like it does in the big woods.
So if you if you're well adept with the Easterns or the Osceolas, you're probably in pretty good shape as far as your hunting techniques and being a you go for the hardest one first, then it kind of sets you up for success on the others. Is that fair to say, or are they different enough?
Fair to say that was our plan, but the ended up taking us the longest. So. Yeah. Well, that's turkey hunting. That's the cool thing about it is, you know, it's a very humbling sport.
Yeah, that's for sure. We pulled into Montana last week to see Turner graduate, and I sent you the video of the Merriam in the field right next to our house. And man, that thing wouldn't shut up. It would come out at about 7 o'clock in the morning, and it was just gobbling its head off all around the house. And then it would disappear all day long, and then it would be back about 6 o'clock, and it would gobble its head off all the way to the roost. It past dark, it's gobbling. And I was like, man, why don't I have any turkeys like this where I turkey hunt? But that turkey seems like it would be real easy to kill. Real easy.
There you go, try to kill him.
Yeah, Turner got an elk call, and he was calling to the thing and made it sound something like a turkey, and the thing was just gobbling back to him and coming. I mean, he was coming. And it's a big difference when you go to start trying to kill them, though. They don't usually act the same.
Congrats to Turner on graduation. God, it just seems like yesterday he went there.
No kidding. Time flies, man. time flies. He has had a really great time there, and Hayden too. They're both out there and managing to, you know, hunt and fish a ton, ski a ton, hike a ton, camp a ton, but keep it together enough to graduate. And pretty impressed, actually. Pretty impressed by that part. You know, there's a lot of distractions.
Multitasking skills down.
That's right, man. There's a lot of distractions. I mean, there's a lot of distractions at any college, but man, you're out there in the middle of Montana in Bozeman, Montana. I mean, man, the kind of distractions, I don't know if you and I could have made it. We'd have been hunting and fishing everywhere, but you know, they do a lot, but Turner managed to balance his time. And you know, there were a lot of times I'm super proud of him for graduating, because there were a lot of times where he just didn't want to do it. And I can't say that I could argue with him that much. I mean, he was like, look, I'm not learning anything that I think I'm ever going to use. And just don't want to do this. And I feel like I'd rather just go to work. And, you know, I was like, well, can't really argue with you. But I just kept saying to him, you know, there are things in this world that require that piece of paper. And if you find that thing, like say for whatever reason, you know, you don't know about it right now, but you decide that you want to be a vet. That's one of the things that requires that you have that piece of paper. And if you find that out when you're 26 and you don't have that piece of paper, man, it's going to be tough for you to go back to school. And I mean, that's just going to be really tough, especially if you got a wife and a baby at home or something. I just kept putting those scenarios in his head. Like, you got time. If you knew what you wanted to do and you were making good money doing it right now, I don't know that I could argue with you. Uh-oh, we lost your video.
Sorry, I was getting, sorry. Somehow I got getting a phone call through airplane mode.
Oh, that's cool. But yeah, it was cool to see him graduate. We got to meet all his friends. We had a little party for him. It was fun. It was a good time. So the other thing that you sent me recently is what I've got to think is the most difficult turkey in the world to kill. And it's this albino piebald turkey that you've been hunting for years.
No, actually we found him this fall.
This fall. Years. You keep sending me pictures of him.
I've been taking pictures of him so much. You know, we took pictures of that thing. I did. I would sit in the blind from 5 to 5 in the afternoon taking pictures of him. And way too much time that I want to say on here. But, you know, I spent a lot of time in the woods on that turkey, and he disappeared on us. The family that I work for in Childersburg, they're a great family. I just, the kids that I hunt for that are there, they're some little killers. They can get them. And we could not find this turkey. And I had a gut feeling towards the end of the season. I don't know. I just couldn't shake it. I was like, I think he might be back in the back corner of these pine woods. And I went checking tracks after a rain. I found one set of gobbler tracks. And I called the boys, Miller and Harris. And I told them, I said, boys, I think he's back here in this set of woods. And about that time, I came out to the cornfield, and there he was in full strut.
Wow.
Oh my goodness. And it was towards the end of the season, so we were running out of time. And so we hunted him for 2 days, and the turkey would not come to calls. He's ultra paranoid. I said he was scared of butterflies. But he just kind of was in his own little, he just had his own little routine that he had stay alive, because other turkeys picked on him.
Oh, they did.
Pretty good. Yeah. But he had girlfriends too at the same time. So he was kind of doing his own thing on the far end of the farm. And when he went away one day, we went towards where his roost was, and there was one white feather sitting under this longleaf pine that turkeys have been roosting in since I was, I guess, 15 years old, 16 years old. It's just been a habitual roost tree. And I just said to my buddy Josh, this is where we need to sit. This is where we need to stay. And the next day we stayed there from daylight to 4:30. And finally at 4:30 he came back to that tree, and we got him. And
it
was a true, one of those unicorns that never thought.
Now, when you're sitting there like that and you just think that you've outsmarted him, is there any reason to call, or are you just waiting to see him come?
He wasn't good to call at. Like, he was one time I called at him and he ran like a cheetah was chasing.
Yeah. Yeah. So, that's what I would think. You know, with a turkey that spooky and that rare and that strange and the life that thing has to have lived, I would think that maybe you just got to get in his way, and I'm not a good
enough. And it's not that the turkey calling was his problem. It's that when he heard a hen, he associated that with other gobblers being with the hen. So he's like, oh no, they're coming to get me. I got to go.
Right.
And so he would just, he did a lot of gobbling, a lot of strutting during the day quietly without doing a ton of gobbling. He would gobble about every hour on his own randomly. But that was a paranoid turkey.
Did it sound like any other turkey, or did it have a particular?
Just like you could. There's no difference.
Couldn't tell any difference. So let's talk about
Eastern wild turkey that lacked pigment, like similar to a piebald deer, but with a lot less pigment.
Yeah. So have you ever seen one even similar to this at all?
There's turkey right here. It's an albino that I killed, a Rio Grande albino that has pink toenails and pink eyes. And I killed that in Texas in the 90s, in the mid 98, I think, 99. And I never even had heard of anything like that. But this turkey had more coloration, had a little pigmentation, but he had white toenails, white spurs, blue eyes, you know. I don't really know. We don't really.
How rare do you think that a turkey like that is?
Somebody told me the other day, but you know, very extremely rare.
Extremely rare. So a turkey that is white and exhibits such difference, like you're saying that the other turkeys are picking on him. Obviously predators could see that turkey. I would think that would be 10 times harder to kill that turkey than any other turkey if it's made it to adulthood in that condition.
So when I would take his pictures, I've been around a lot of gobblers, and I've been into turkey photography now pretty good for about 4 years, to where I spend a lot of time with them. And I kind of get to know when I can move and do things, but that turkey always, any little thing that was weird, he would just back out. And he wouldn't ask either. He would just start leaving, and he'd gone. And the same thing with hunting him. The second day before we killed him, we're sitting there yelping at him, and coyotes came from all around closing him, running across the ag field. They knew his gobble. And so because he was white, they knew that the predators knew when he started gobbling, that was him. I mean, they know that. I mean, it may sound like the same gobbler to us, but they know that's that gobbler. He's in that area, and they're flanking him. So there's a swamp in the middle, and they were trying to go around one side. We're sitting on the other. So he had a really tough life, we would assume.
Yeah. But tell me about like these pictures that you send me, and for everybody that's listening, Graham and I have a text thread that we send each other pictures of awesome animals or big fish or whatever we're happening to catch or killing at the time. But one thing that he's been sending me regularly are these pictures, these incredible pictures. And you can see a lot of them on your Instagram, right? The ones that you've taken of these turkeys, but you take these incredible pictures of turkeys. And when I see that, I'm like, man, you're so close. You have to be so close to that turkey. Like, even if you have a 400 millimeter lens, you're way closer than bow range to these turkeys, it seems like. How do you do that?
Well, when I'm taking the pictures of the turkeys, I like getting in gun range, like I would be hunting. I try to position myself right there. I don't like to be away from them. In any photography situation, like, it's just another game, you know, to play with light and where you are and being in the right position. And in turkey photography, it's best not to be calling a bunch, because the turkeys come in and they're looking for the hen that was calling, then they'll walk off. You don't get any pictures. So it's best to hunt them like the Indians did and kind of get where they are and intercept them in their core areas and be there so you can be with them to take more pictures. So it's kind of made me hunt a little different as well.
Mm-hmm. But does it make you better? Do you think you've gotten to be a better turkey hunter because of the photography?
Because I sit there from 5 in the morning sometimes to 3 in the afternoon. I'm with them all a lot. I'm with them a lot. and I I kind of get to anticipate their movements a different way. And I feel like, I don't know, it may sound weird. I don't know. I kind of feel like I can put myself in their shoes a little bit better by being around them a lot.
Right. And so when you're around them a lot, say they come into where you set up, where you think they're going to come into this field or whatever, and you set up there just like you would hunting, and then they move off of that field for whatever reason. Maybe they sense you, maybe they just have spent enough time there. Will you follow them? Do you start following them and you don't ever follow them?
No, I'm not big on it, because then I deplete my resource. If I try to follow them and I bump them or something, then they know what's up. And then, I mean, once the turkey knows he's being hunted, it's really hard to get back on him again. I mean, they have that going for them. So I'd really try to baby them, and I float around the radius of their core areas and hope they come to me that way. But big thing we do is we try to never go into their areas ever. You know, we try to get them on the outside.
Wait, so never go in there, but you want to be, I mean, it's okay to be there before they get there, right?
Right. In the morning time, that's right. Your shot.
Right.
In the daylight. And if you can get out of there without them knowing, you're a lot better for the next day, and then repeat it. But, you know, the afternoon hunting can be very effective, especially towards the end of the season. But going in the daylight to afternoon hunt, the turkey can be anywhere, and then he's going to nail you with his eyes and move off. And so you've lost him, not for the next morning, probably for a week or so, a lot of times.
Yeah. Well, I'm very familiar with that scenario. That seems like that's really easy to do. I mean, you when you're checking out a new piece of property or whatever, and you kind of poke your head out into this field and you're looking and you think, okay, well, I don't see anything, even scan it with binoculars. And then you take two steps out there and you hear one go pop, 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 and run off. Man, how did I not see them? But you just don't. They got their head peeking, you know, a quarter inch over a little hill, and you don't see them. You can't see them. But they see you.
That's one of the biggest things people ask me is, what do you do when they get to about 80 yards and they won't come in? Like, what you do is you don't call at them anymore, and you sit there for an hour and you let their mind take over, and they think that the hen left and they come walking up there. If you keep yelping at them, they're just going to stay at 80 yards locked up. So you play hard to get, and here they go. So. And it's hard when you're watching, when you're trying to sit there and be real quiet for a long period of time. We call it icing them. You call it icing a turkey when you be quiet on them for a long time. And one tip that I can say to anybody who may be listening to this is have a phone, because I like to do 15-minute silence intervals. Sometimes if that doesn't work, step it up to 30. But you need to watch your watch or your phone, because a 15 minutes of silence when you're working a turkey may be like 3 in your mind.
Yeah, right.
So you need to watch the clock to make sure that you're really being as quiet as you need to be to get him to move. Mm. Because if you keep talking to him, he's just going to sit out there and gobble, you know, most of the time, especially in public land. So.
That public land hunting, man, that's a different deal. They're getting pressure from all over, and you don't know, you don't know how much they had yesterday or what, you know?
Yeah. A lot of times you got to use the opposite tactic on the public land turkeys. Like, you get a ridge and you put your buddy, you get the turkey gobbling, and you get on one side of the turkey, tell your best bud, your best hunting buddy, to go all the way around the other side on the ridge. You start calling at him and the turkey walks away, because he's so used to calling pressure, and your buddy kills him going away down the rig.
Mm-hmm.
So there are things you can do on public land that are that you can do to get them when you're on public land. That is one tip that I just said that was very effective.
Yeah, well, I mean, that would work on private land too, I guess. If you knew that if you had seen that behavior before, like if you just keep
especially
calling
hens up turkeys where the hens are going to take them away. When they got a big harem of hens, if you tell your buddy to loop them and you start yelping, and it's on a ridge, like a terrain situation where they're going to walk the ridge, then you, most of the time, you got them that way.
Mm-hmm. So when you're telling your friend to make a loop around them, and you're on a ridge and, you know, it's dry or whatever, and you're making you can be pretty loud in the woods, even if you're really trying to be very quiet. How far around them do you need to go to where they can't hear you, or do you need to just use the land to where they can't see you?
A lot of times, believe it or not, on ridge turkeys, when they hear that noise, they come to you, gobbling, thinking it's another hen.
Yeah.
So you got to be careful in that aspect. But I like to try to get around 200 yards down ridge of them and have somebody call them to you, you know. And that happens a lot with older turkeys, too, where you got to loop them and have them go the other way. Mm.
And then I guess it could, you could, your buddy could get down there. And if that turkey doesn't come, maybe they make a call and it comes, bounces back to you.
Yeah. Yeah. And then sometimes you sit there so long being silent, waiting for them to come into your buddy that you get it.
Yeah. That's awesome. That's awesome. So, how much more turkey hunting do you have this season?
Oh, we're totally done.
Totally done.
Yep. Season ended May 2nd in Alabama. And so it's on to other things.
Uh-huh. And the other things that have occupied your interest lately, been tarpon fishing. I know that.
Yeah. That I have that problem.
That's a problem that a lot of us have. And it becomes a problem because, man, when you see that going down, it's pretty awesome. The tarpon fishing. I know we're going to go in August. I've got it on my calendar. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. Yeah. I look forward to it too. Very much. So that's an interesting game y'all play. I'm learning. So, it's a very fun thing to be, you know, to watch and to learn, and, you know, just like everything, it's kind of like you were saying, it's just like doing one little thing, but you could do one little thing different and it'd be that big of a difference.
It does. And you know, the tarpon and the turkey, I think are, well, I don't know. I don't know if the turkey has this, but the tarpon for sure can be a very shy fish. It can be a fish that, you know, any little movement, any little anything, just they don't like it and they're gone. And then on the other hand, they can be super aggressive, and they can also eat, you know, fish table scraps right off the of every fillet table in South Florida. And they just have all of these different kind of behaviors, like that being the fish that's at the fish cleaning table. I mean, they will inhale an entire fish skin off a 40-pound dolphin like it's nothing. Like, you know, and they'll eat an entire fish head, and we're throwing little flies at them that are 2 inches long, and we're thinking that's too big. And then if you go to the fish cleaning table, they're eating these massive things. When you're fishing them at the bridge, they're eating these 2.5-pound mullet, like, and doing it very, very aggressively. So I find that the tarpon is just a really, it's just an interesting fish because it has all of these different things that can turn them on, or turn them off, you know, like, I don't know. It's just an interesting fish, and you get in these different situations and different, places and they act different. And if you're prepared for it, you know, good for you. You can handle it. Like if you go to a place and all you have is fly tackle, you may not have any chance of catching them. If you go to a place and all you have are live mullet, you may not have any chance of catching them. But if you take the live mullet to where that works really well, it's unbelievable. And the same thing with the fly. If you can get into these situations where the fly is what they want, if you cast a live mullet over there, it would just blow them all up. Like they would just blow up.
The fly seems to be, I mean, the way that you can keep the fly where it needs to be seems to be the deadliest, at least from what I've seen. I mean, there may be something else out there, but.
Well, there's just different situations, you know, like if they're all sitting in a channel or sitting in a bridge or sitting somewhere in deeper water, you know, you're not going to be able to present the fly in a way that that's going to be interesting to them. But I don't know. They're just a different fish, you know, totally different fish.
Nothing gets my knees shaking and my heart beating like that. No turkey, no deer, no nothing.
Yeah.
Just nothing. Nothing in the world. think about those things all year now. That's a bug that I have.
Yeah, I know. Well, a lot of people get that bug real quick because there are an amazing fish like that. All right, man. Well, what an incredible year you've had with the slam turkey and then this albino turkey. I mean, really, when you think back on your turkey hunting career, I know you've done some amazing things, and probably some of the most amazing things, very similar to my fishing career, are things that would never stand out in a record book or anything like that. But it's getting someone a particular fish that they just were not going to be able to get without you, or, you know, in your case, a particular turkey that just, you know, maybe it wasn't even a very impressive turkey, but a lot of times those stack up at your career. When you look back on it, you're like, that's one that I'm really, really proud of. But as your turkey career kind of stacks up, how did this year compare to others?
It was a great year, simply because I hunted less. I've a 2-year-old and a 6-month-old. So I hadn't been able to go every day, like all the time. But out of all the years, I guess when the best turkey hunt that I've had is when I took my wife for 5 years trying to get her a turkey, and that was the best turkey still. She's never been back, but that day was to me the best one, because it had taken 5 years for us to kill that turkey to get her. I'd been pretty hard on her for those couple of years, and when she finally killed that turkey, that was my favorite turkey.
Listen, it was her favorite turkey too, because she didn't have to go anymore. Hey, look at there.
Hey, Mr. Tom.
You are covered up with Band-Aids. What is going on with your legs?
She likes Band-Aids.
Do you? Your dad likes Band-Aids too, but he actually needs them.
Hey, Mr. Tom.
Hi. When's her first turkey?
When are you going to go turkey hunting, too?
She will. Something tells me that she'll be gone. She might catch a tarpon first, though.
She likes to feed the tarpon.
Yeah.
We feed them plastic zoom worms.
Yeah, that's a great thing to feed them.
Yeah,
that's a great thing.
We stick worms in the striper's mouth.
Uh huh. Well, listen, man, I know you got your hands full. I can see everybody's coming home, and that's a perfect way to end it, man. I appreciate you telling us the story of the Grand Slam. Congratulations for that, and then really congratulations on the piebald turkey too, and also congratulations on, you know, putting your priorities at the top and spending more time with your family. That's awesome. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, we got to get you striper fishing this year.
I'm ready, man.
Looked at them today.
Did you? I'm ready. Yeah. You tell me when and I'll be there.
All right.
Okay, buddy. Hey, listen, Graham, thank you. And as always, it's great to connect with you. You're one of my favorite people to hunt and fish with, and I really learn something new from you every time. Tell people how they can follow you and see what you're up to and what you've been doing.
Well, most of my fishing stuff's on Instagram at Graham Talo, and then my turkey stuff's at Alabama Land. If you want to see a lot of turkey pictures and things of that nature, it's on Alabama Land.
Right on. If you need a farm, you can help them with that too.
Yeah, I can.
All right, man. Have a great day. I really appreciate it, and we'll talk and fish and hunt soon.
Okay, sounds good. Say bye, Mr. Tom.
Bye, Teal. See ya.